Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So tomorrow, we're all going shopping again, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us this Christmas Day, December 25th. As I am reading this, some holiday revelers out there are quickly morphing into post-Christmas shopping strategists. Sale prices are popping up online already. Walmart, JCPenney, and Toys R Us are planning to open bright and early tomorrow morning. And this year, retailers have 3 days to lure us out to buy all the stuff we hoped for but didn't get. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Oh, see, look at that color.
The aqua.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
So I started my end of Christmas retail research late yesterday afternoon, Christmas Eve, at something called the Festival of the Last Minute in Portland, Oregon. Britt Fredrickson was out shopping at the open-air craft market for some last-minute gifts, and I asked if she'd be out first-minute Friday morning hunting for bargains.
I have in the past, but I probably won't now. Probably not brave the crowds. Just don't need any more stuff right now.
Other folks I spoke to just wanted to be done. But Jessica Martin Weber said she's looking forward to getting out to the stores again. She's got 6 girls at home.
My husband and I typically get the day after Christmas or the day after that, where we go catch a movie and we do some shopping.
And this year, it's a somewhat rare 3-day post-holiday shopping weekend. Many people will be taking off work, which could give a boost to retailers, says analyst Klaus Bell at Bankrate.com.
Giving people more time to shop, giving them a little more room, and giving them a little bit more money in their pocket thanks to lower gas prices could make a difference for retailers.
So could gift cards, which are more popular than ever and can often be a license for consumers to spend it up, says economist Chris Christopher at IHS.
Using gift cards and or credit cards, people spend more than if they use their own hard-earned cash.
Christopher is predicting this year consumers will spend 4% more than last year on holiday shopping. And with the recession fading into memory and people feeling more optimistic about the economy, Bankrate's Klaus Bell says consumers are reacquainting themselves with debt.
We're kind of returning more to normal where people are willing to borrow, to buy cars, to finance consumer spending.
All of which could make for a strong post-Christmas and post-post-Christmas shopping season. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Yes, post-post-Christmas is a lot about shopping, I'll give you that. But it's also about giving. 'Tis the season for philanthropy. A few days ago, one large charitable gift made news. Sean Parker, the entrepreneur who founded Napster and was the first president of Facebook, gave $24 million to Stanford University. The money will create a center for research into food allergies. As Marketplace's Noel King reports, it's charity that begins at home.
Sean Parker is extremely allergic to nuts, peanuts, tree nuts, also shellfish. He asks waiters to run down the ingredients of dishes before he orders and carries an EpiPen. His food allergies have landed him in the hospital more than once. So his $24 million donation to Stanford to create the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research may seem a little self-interested. Lucy Bernholz, a visiting scholar at Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, says that's not unusual.
There's a long history of people who are either directly affected by a disease or who have family members who are suffering from a disease being donors to that specific cause.
For example, Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, has given millions to the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. Parkinson's runs in Brin's family. Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, says Parker's donation directly to Stanford is in line with the way many young tech entrepreneurs give these days.
You absolutely see him doing a lot of research and understanding the science and caring about it. He didn't set up his own foundation to deal with this issue. So those are some of the hallmarks of these newer philanthropists.
But if wealthy individuals so frequently give to causes that affect them directly, is a lot of charity just enlightened self-interest? Palmer says most of the time it's not an either-or situation.
Sometimes self-interest means something that benefits lots of people. When you give a gift to your alma mater, you might be able to say that it's for more scholarships for people, but it also might be so that your kid could get into school.
Palmer says one likely result of Parker's gift, it will draw attention to how many people, around 1 in 12 children, suffer from food allergies. And she says philanthropists often give to many causes. $24 million is a lot of money, but Parker is worth an estimated $3 billion, which means he's still got plenty left to spread around. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Markets were closed today, so we'll get a little creative when we do the numbers. Santa tucked a lot of Frozen-themed toys under trees last night, but he also brought some classics, toys that have kept their charm year after year.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
In our special series called Holidays Brought to You By, Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta looks at a top toy from three decades ago, which still has fans today.
Picture it. Small town Kentucky, 1984. Five-year-old Jimmy and eight-year-old Shannon want one thing for Christmas, a Cabbage Patch doll.
Hello.
Hey, sis, how are you?
Hey, just fine. How are you?
Good, good. For the backstory, I hit up my sister, who still lives in Kentucky.
Why did we want Cabbage Patch Kids that year?
Because everybody had them, and that was the talk. Whether you were a boy or whether you were a girl, you had to have a Cabbage Patch Kid, and it had to look like you.
The story goes, Dad finally found the last few Cabbage Patch Kids just before Christmas. In what sounds like a sketchy backroom deal, he paid some guy a 300% premium for Carolina Jacobina and Wiley Irving.
One, two, three, push!
Fast forward 30 years.
This is our beautiful baby girl.
And Mother Cabbage Patch is still pushing out little boy and girl dolls ready for adoption. No, really, like picture a green Cabbage Patch the size of an amusement park carousel with a nurse stationed in its middle, pulling out naked newborn dolls.
Alrighty.
It happens 7 days a week here in Georgia.
I'm Margaret McLean, the Director of Corporate Communications here at Babyland General Hospital, home of the Cabbage Patch Kids in Cleveland, Georgia.
Nestled in the North Georgia mountains, Babyland General is a 70,000 square foot replica of an antebellum mansion. It's part museum, part endless retail store. And it's a far cry from the humble beginnings where Xavier Roberts first created Little People in the late 70s. By 1982, the name changed to Cabbage Patch Kids. And for the next few years, they were the standard by which all toys were judged.
The demand was not expected. I mean, sometimes you just do not anticipate what was going to happen.
Unlike most popular toys, sales remain strong. In 2010, Time magazine named the Cabbage Patch to its top 10 toy crazes of all time.
I was four, and I was very excited. It had blonde hair and blue eyes like me.
Now, parents like Emily Horace bring their children here to adopt Cabbage Patch Kids. That's what her son, four-year-old Cody, is doing.
What kind of Cabbage Patch do you want, a boy or a girl?
A girl.
Why a girl?
Because I like it.
But what is it about the Cabbage Patch that still makes kids like it? Chris Bench is chief curator for the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York. It's home to the National Toy Hall of Fame.
It's kind of a classic baby doll, except it's not. It's different.
Bench says the Cabbage Patch doll's adoption papers, custom hair and eye colors, and unusual names distinguish it. So much so, the Cabbage Patch was a finalist for inclusion to the Hall of Fame in 2010. It didn't win.
I have every confidence that Cabbage Patch Kids will eventually get in. It just wasn't their year in 2010.
That was the year for the Game of Life and playing cards. At least the Cabbage Patch wasn't competing in 2005. That's the year the cardboard box won. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
The U.S. is transporting more and more stuff by rail, everything from grain to oil to farm supplies. This week, the trade group for the railroad said trains are moving about 4% more volume this year than last. But all that traffic is causing some headaches, literally. People who live near railroad tracks complain that train horns are disruptive. They're loud. There is a way for cities to quiet some of that whistleblowing, but the process can be expensive and complicated. Grace Hood from member station KUNC reports.
The federal agency overseeing trains requires engineers to sound their horns for at least 15 seconds before all public road crossings. Since the rule went into effect a decade ago, fatalities have decreased more than 37% at intersections. But in Fort Collins, Colorado, a town literally built around the railroad tracks, progress is bringing complaints, lots of them.
Yeah, it's word of mouth, it's emails, it's calls, it's being out here when there's a train and watching everybody covering their ears.
Joe Olson is a traffic engineer for the city. He's working on a plan to reduce train horns by creating a federally regulated quiet zone that involves multiple steps and visits from the Federal Railroad Administration. And the whole process can take years.
You're really rebuilding the intersection there. You know, you have to demonstrate that you're maintaining the same safety that a train horn would.
Michael Wallace is with the National League of Cities. He says each community has unique design challenges, and getting the project off the ground can be expensive.
These are multiple million dollars of improvements that you have to put in there, so it's a difficult question.
In a written statement, a spokesman for the FRA acknowledged that working through all the details related to quiet zones can take, quote, a significant amount of time. In Fort Collins, more than a dozen trains pass through town every day. Isaac Smeltzer works in an office right by the tracks. He's had to stop several conference calls because of train horn noise.
We always joke because we use rail for our business. So I guess it's just something that's become part of our daily lives, and it's just a reminder that it's here.
Relief won't be coming anytime soon. Fort Collins plans to apply for a waiver from specific quiet zone requirements. Once that's been approved, it will move forward with its overall application, an effort that right now has no timeline for completion. I'm Grace Hood for Marketplace.
Going to the archives as we wrap up our 25th year on the air to share some of the stories that our staff and listeners loved. In keeping with the holidays, here's a piece from our series, Best Gift Ever.
I'm violinist Joshua Bell. The greatest gift that was ever given to me was given to me on January 1st, 1995, by my beloved mentor, Joseph Gingold. I had been studying with him since I was 12 years old, and he was like a grandfather to me. And I grew up in his studio taking lessons and looking at all his incredible autographs and signed photos of great musicians. His greatest one was this Paganini autograph that I always looked at and was inspired by. In 1995, I had been living in New York and had a career of my own and hadn't seen Mr. Gingold for almost a year, and so I decided to pay him a quick visit and get something I always wanted from him. A signed photo of himself so I could put it up on my wall. Well, that morning, January 1st, he had two things in his hands. The signed photo of himself and also his Paganini autograph. As it turns out, the very following day, Mr. Gingold had a stroke and he never regained consciousness and I never saw him again. So it was an incredible gift for me not only to have this autograph and to have this signed photo of himself that now sits on my wall, but also to have that last day with him and have this moment of closure.
Joshua Bell is a violinist and a conductor.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Good news if you're working for the federal government. President Obama issued an executive order earlier this month to give federal workers the day off. The markets are open for a shortened session, and Bitcoin takes center stage for the Bitcoin St. Petersburg Bowl between NC State and UCF. I'm Raghu Manavalan.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. A whole lot of us are looking forward to gorging or have already been gorging today. I had a cookie for breakfast and another cookie for a snack. But this being Marketplace and all, we got to wondering if you can copyright those holiday treats or any other recipe. We called up Jane Ginsberg, professor at Columbia Law School, to find out. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So let's say I have a brilliant sugar cookie recipe. Can I copyright it?
You can copyright your literary expression of the recipe, but you can't copyright the cookie, and you can't copyright the ingredients or the steps necessary to make the cookie.
What is my literary expression of a recipe? What's that mean?
That means the way you tell people how to create the cookie. For example, my father's recipes have been published, and they contain a lot of personalized asides, such as, if the sauce looks like a gloppy mess, do not be discouraged.
And so that is copyrightable if he wanted to copyright the gloppy mess.
Well, I don't know that he would want to claim any exclusive rights in the mess, but in that kind of personal touch, that's the sort of thing that copyright protects.
What are the economic implications of recipes that are not copyrightable?
Well, cookbooks still sell, but think about various culinary trends. So, for example, the Catalan chef Ferran Adrià invented micro cooking, and that included a number of flourishes like foam. So you got foam of all
right.
kinds of flavors. In time, foam started showing up everywhere, but he can't charge royalties to every restaurant that adds foam to their preparations.
How would the economic picture shift or the creative picture shift if there were copyright laws that covered these sorts of things like foam?
I suppose the concern would indeed be that the first creator could demand licenses from anybody who used the recipe either in its complete form or possibly even variations, because the copyright law gives the author not only the right to reproduce the work, but also to make derivative works, which is any form in which the work can be recast, transformed, or adapted. That could give the chef an extraordinarily wide monopoly. The culinary world seems to have done okay without copyright, so maybe it's not a good idea to introduce private monopoly rights if they're not necessary to provide an incentive to the creators of culinary works.
Jane Ginsberg is a law professor at Columbia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marijuana industry in the U.S. is now worth billions of dollars and growing. It's got investors excited to jump in. But the limbo of selling something that's legal in some states and illegal according to the feds, it's thrown a dash of chaos into the stew of capitalism. Tim Fitzsimmons reports.
There are plenty of stocks to buy in the booming legal weed industry, and they're cheap. Bad idea, says Alan Brockstein, founder of 420investor.com.
Are what are known as pink sheet companies, an extremely risky sector, kind of the wild, wild west when it comes to, I hate to use the word investing because it's really more gambling, trading, speculating.
A lot of these so-called pot industry stocks are the very same kinds that Jordan Belfort sold in the 2013 movie Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, reason for the call today, John, is something just came across my desk, John. It is perhaps the best thing I've seen in the last 6 months. You got a minute?
These cheap marijuana stocks got shady enough that the SEC issued an investor warning in May, saying many weren't even real businesses. But there is legal money flowing into this industry. So how?
Mark Twain had a great quote. He said, when there is a gold rush going on, it's a good time to be in the pick and shovel business. And that's exactly what's happening now.
That's Troy Dayton, the CEO of ArcView Group, which helps connect investors with businesses working in the legal marijuana industry. For instance,
everything from soil to lighting equipment to insurance products to real estate to software services and delivery apps and you name it. I mean, there's just an absolute boom happening in all of the things that surround the industry.
So closely examine your investment and make sure it isn't touching anything stinky. I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Yes, holidays are about family and presents and sugar cookies and fabulously ugly Christmas sweaters. I had one once that I made by hand by attaching ribbons and bells to a red sweater. It was amazing, just amazing. I don't even have words. Turns out those ugly holiday sweaters are having a resurgence and an industry sprung up around them. WABE's Michelle Aloy reports.
Before the invites to ugly holiday sweater parties started popping up on Facebook, there were people who actually wore these things without the slightest hint of irony, like my mom, Christine. I asked her to show me her favorite ugly Christmas sweater. Yes, she has more than one.
On one side, there is a church, and on the back, there are some angels, and it's supposed to be representative of the song Silent Night.
Believe it or not, Mom is selling this sweater short. The Christmas trees, angels, and church on the sweater are all adorned with hand-sewn silver and gold beading.
You glisten when you walk.
Mom says 20 years ago, a Christmas sweater like this would have cost about $100. It's these kind of sweaters that Mike Gollum is after. He's the founder of UglySweaterStore.com.
It was a very expensive sweater back in the day, which is why they last so long now. So, to have a sweater that's 30 years old now and it's still in great condition is, a testament to how well they did make them.
Gollum has been in the ugly sweater business for 6 years. He usually buys the vintage sweaters in bulk from clothing recyclers and sells them for anywhere between $10 and $100. It's a side job for him. Gollum manages housing for a university in St. Louis. But he says if he wanted to quit his main job, he could, thanks to the growing ugly Christmas sweater party trend.
And it used to just be the college kids or somebody in their 20s, and now we started to see more corporate parties last year, and then this year that's just exploded.
Gollum says 95% of his business falls in the 8 to 10 weeks before Christmas. Jack McCarthy says that's about the same for his sweater business, UltimateUglyChristmas.com.
I'm spending a lot of the summer really getting ready. Finding the inventory, doing the operational side of it.
When he's not selling sweaters, McCarthy is a student at Babson College near Boston. He sold his first ugly sweater on eBay when he was in eighth grade and found big demand. McCarthy says last year he brought in around $50,000. Not bad for a college kid.
I can do, all the work during the summer and then run it online now.
But both McCarthy and Gollum say selling sweaters this year has been more difficult. That's because more big-name retailers like Target, Walmart, and Macy's have gotten into the ugly sweater business. Even major sports leagues like the NFL and NBA now have their own lines of ugly holiday sweaters. Again, Mike Gollum.
It's hard. It's kind of like if you're a mom-and-pop shop and then Home Depot moves into town.
McCarthy says he's seen traffic to his website drop a little as it's fallen on the Google search options behind these big-box stores. But he says he's used social media to raise his sweater's profile.
People share the pictures, find them funny, and kind of share the site. So kind of word-of-mouth advertising has been helpful.
Both say they're looking to diversify the kinds of things they sell. And there are other holiday ugly sweater markets to explore. Just ask my mom.
Yes, I have a St. Patrick sweater and an Easter sweater and a 4th of July sweater.
She forgot to mention her Halloween sweater and her Thanksgiving sweater, too. In Atlanta, I'm Michelle Aloy for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
One final note before we finish up today. The white Christmas that Irving Berlin dreamt about, it was uncommon this year around the country. One place that did get a little snow was Hawaii. Two mountains on the Big Island had a rare blizzard. The snow is only expected to last a day or two, but if you're really desperate to see the white stuff, you could fly today from LA for about $700. And that's our show today. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. Happy holidays, everyone. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.